The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Bernard Schiff is an emeritus professor at the University of Toronto and the man responsible for helping Professor Jordan Peterson get hired some 20 years ago. Professor Schiff is also the author of an essay entitled, "I Was Jordan Peterson's Strongest Supporter. Now I Think He's Dangerous." It's Wednesday, June 6, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books. But this week, I am not the host of the Zero Books podcast. Instead, you'll hear from J.G. Michael, who co-hosts the Alternatives podcast with Derek Varn, and hosts his own podcast entitled Parallax Views. It will be J.G. Michael who's interviewing Professor Schiff. Thanks goes out to Eric T.K., Liam M., Alex M., and 337 other supporters on Patreon who get access to the Inside Zero Books podcast every weekend. Coming up this weekend, patrons will get to hear the panel discussion on video games from the Left Forum that was recorded over last weekend, and I'll be releasing the surplus value versus surplus enjoyment debate on the main feed sometime very soon. The music you're listening to right now is an 8-bit version of Mozart's Symphony 41, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to J.G. Michael and Professor Bernard Schiff discuss Schiff's inside critique of Jordan Peterson.
Welcome, Dr. Bernard Schiff.
Nice to be here.
So, you recently wrote a piece in the Star from Toronto entitled, "I Was Jordan Peterson's Strongest Supporter. Now I Think He's Dangerous."
If anybody read the piece, they know that I virtually was responsible for hiring him about 20 years ago. And the other people on the search committee were skeptical, but I prevailed. And they had reasons to be skeptical, and I thought this guy would bring excitement and new ideas to the department. And I think he did. It then turned out to be he was quite more eccentric in ways that I have not expected. He insisted on challenging the Ethics Review Committee. He did not want to have his research subject to the Ethics Review. And he also, as a teacher, had fantastic teaching reviews, eyebrow-raising comments like, "This course has changed my life." And I was thinking, is that a good thing or a bad thing in a university course? You know, which is supposed to open the mind, but not shatter in quite that way. In any case, there was one student who wrote a review saying, "I hated this course because it was full of delivered truths." I became curious. I went to that class, and indeed, it felt to me these were delivered truths. Jordan is a fantastic storyteller. He weaves tales from mythology and the Bible and popular culture and science, and he weaves them into a story that's pretty interesting, but it's a story, it's an idea. And in the end, it always sounded like he was delivering it to the class as if this was a fact. So I had this conversation with Jordan a number of times, actually, saying, "You know, Jordan, it's terrific. I think it's really compelling, and the students love it. But there's a problem. I think you delivered this the truth." And then he would quote something from Jung, and I don't remember what the quote was. It was always the same quote about the dangers of doing things like this. And then he would continue to do it. It's almost as if he could not stop himself. So I thought that was a problem. I thought his objections being reviewed, the arrogance in that, you know, he thought they weren't qualified. He also thought that he, You know, he's perfectly capable of making his own decisions about ethics in his research. They were really odd, but I thought that was his youthful enthusiasm and unbridled, and that was also a virtue, and I sort of gave him a wide berth with that. So that's what appeared later in his life to become a problem. The reason that I wanted to do this is partly because he did bring grief to our university, and I felt I had a responsibility for telling things about Jordan that people didn't know, that may give him a way of thinking about what he's doing. I also was concerned because as he became extremely popular, I saw that he was having an impact on large numbers of young people, but also people who weren't paying close attention. There are many kinds of Jordans. There's a good Jordan and the bad Jordan, and depending on what you've seen, you think he's a good guy or a bad guy, they should pay more attention. The other thing that at this particular time is an election that is going to be taking place in a few days here in the province of Ontario, and I had reason to believe that he was a player in the Conservative Party and a dangerous player, and I thought I wanted to get these stories out before the election. So those are the reasons that I wrote it. I should also tell you that the headline was not mine. Throughout that article, if anyone has read it, I wonder about the possibilities of him being dangerous. But I didn't say he was. And if he is dangerous, it's for very particular reasons that that we'll come back to later, I'm sure.
Dr. Peterson, you mentioned that he sort of promotes a social Darwinist way of thinking. Could you comment on that and how there's been this sort of return to social Darwinism in the public discourse?
He is a biological determinist. He thinks that our gender is biologically determined, and he thinks gender roles have been selected biologically over years of evolution. But the social Darwinists were a particular group of biological determinists in the 1800s, I think, they rose to some prominence, who believed that any intervention in the natural order, the natural order being the evolutionarily determined one, that any intervention from government or otherwise was dangerous and should not be done. So that we are who we are, and we should not try to change that. Now, that idea went out of fashion through the 20th century because there was too much new information that made that nonsensical. Now, Jordan really does behave like a social Darwinist because he does believe in the absolute determination of who we are biologically, and he thinks we should not toy with it. He thinks this is a social order. Jordan came out as a kind of free speech warrior. When he first rose to prominence, it was, well, you'll come back to that, an argument in the defense of free speech. But in that article, I do an analysis of a whole bunch of things that he's doing, which made it clear to me that he was not a free speech activist. He was a social order activist. He was out there to protect the social order. And the social order he was protecting was pretty primitive and also in many ways sort of laughable because, you know, he says evolution determined dominance hierarchies, the relationships between men and women, you know, the kind of thing that you hear him talking about. Well, 90% of human evolution or recorded human existence, we were hunter-gatherers. And hunter-gatherers were people who were societies that hunted or foraged for their food. And there was often a division of labor where the men hunted the women because they were strong, the women foraged at the home because they were weaker and they bore children. But those were not socially unequal. Many of them were not. those hunter-gatherers were pretty egalitarian, and that women were as influential and as powerful as men. In fact, Karl Marx defined socioeconomic system as primitive communism. Now, if we are determined biologically, a lot of that would have happened over 90% of our development. And it's just not who we were as hunter-gatherers. Now, what's interesting is our closest relative, the chimpanzee, is extremely hierarchical. We're organized around an alpha male, and with everything that follows from that in terms of mate selection and competition. Well, those are chimpanzees. And what's interesting is that a lot of paleoanthropologists think that it was the resistance to being dominated, which was happening in our relatives, the chimpanzees, was a big factor driving the evolutionary emergence of human consciousness, language, kinship, and social organization. So when Jordan presents that view of the social order, he is either willfully or ignorantly ignoring a lot of anthropological knowledge. Now, I'm not an anthropologist, but that's what I know. And I did actually do a little bit of reading about this before we had this conversation to see that it was pretty much what is believed to be true. So I think that could be part of the reason that social Darwinism fell out of favor. In fact, the history of human evolution and has to do with actually changing the nature of the social order, evolving it from a highly dominant one, male dominant, to one that's different. Now, along the way, many iterations, many variations of that appeared, but that is what's so weird about what Jordan is doing. And when you say that's back in the discourse, well, I guess, certainly Jordan may be to a large extent responsible for reviving that in people's consciousness or in the consciousness of some people. I haven't thought about whether that's actually pervasive. It's certainly something that's, I haven't thought about the pervasiveness of that, but it's certainly something that, and one of the things that's dangerous, I think, about Jordan is gathering followers who are feeling out enabled and empowered about that idea about the order of society.
That kind of misrepresentation about this biological determinism that Dr. Peterson promotes is just one of many misrepresentations that we find. If we could, let's segue into Bill C-16 and gender identity.
Okay, that's an interesting one. And that's what first alarmed me about Jordan is Bill C-16 was an amendment to a Human Rights Act that was adding gender and gender identity to a list of vulnerable groups who were protected by a Human Rights Act. And he said that the implications of that is that he would be required to address students with a non-gender or a gender-neutral pronoun if asked, and he would not do it. And he made that made a very strong case to that, and it created a lot of anger, and that's what got him going. Now, the truth is that, and then the other thing he did say is that if he did do that, he could go to jail. Well, the simple misrepresentation was the Human Rights Act can only impose a fine. If somebody complains to the Human Rights Tribunal, they can fine you for transgressing or breaking the code. They cannot put you in jail. And when I challenged Jordan with that, he said, Well, he could go to jail. He's checked with the top constitutional lawyers in the country, and they said they'll fine you, and if you don't pay the fine, you can go to jail. Well, that's very different from being went to jail for something you had said. But it's not even clear that the human rights code, it's not even clear that refusing to comply with the pronouns would be a violation of the code. The code is written to end discrimination directly or indirectly of vulnerable people, discrimination to refuse to employ, and the other thing is that it's protecting them from the discrimination to decide to deny access to goods and services and facilities. There's nothing in the code itself that says anything about language. That's the code. There are tribunals all over the country that can hear cases. And in the recommendations for the tribunal can include language. Now, for someone to violate the code with language, just saying no to a student, I will not comply with that, is not a violation of the code. What would be a violation of the code, I think, is if he then insisted on addressing them with a pronoun that they did not want to have. He could, a student can say, Dr. Peterson, I do not want to be, I want to be referred to as they, and he will say, I won't do that, but I will address you by your proper name or something else like that. If he proved in an aggressive way to call them he or she, I think that might qualify for an appeal to the tribunal, and the tribunal might rule against him, and he could be fined. Very unlikely, unless he was really wanting to be fined, it's very unlikely that this would have gotten to the tribunal. Now, there is a hate code in Canada also, and I guess his fear is, well, what's going to be in the, this is going to apply to the hate code also eventually, but the hate code is written for language advocating genocide, the powerful incitement of hatred. It's just there's no way that language violations like that, unless they're done in an extremely nasty, public, and provocative way, would ever get to the hate code. So that was a huge misrepresentation. And, you know, Jordan just, you know, I remember there were debates about this on television, and there was a lawyer there who said, but Jordan, you can't go to jail for this. He just wouldn't answer that question. He just would not answer that question. Now, one of the things about Jordan after he's done what he's done is when people challenge him, he'll either say, well, I didn't really say it. I didn't mean it exactly that way. He's always, there's always a restatement of something to make it fit whatever the pressures are that are on him. But also, he produces so much information that it's hard to keep track of what's going on. So, yes, that was the grotesque misrepresentation of the law itself.
Dr. Peterson retweeted your article, and there were some misrepresentations going on with that as well.
When I wrote the article, I have a trans daughter, and I knew that since I was the initial provocative problem was him arguing against accommodating the demands of a transgender or gender neutral person. I knew that if I didn't say I had a trans daughter, Jordan could come against me and say, you can forget everything that he wrote because he has a trans daughter. He didn't tell you that. And he's doing this because he's angry because I opposed Bill C-16. That was soon, you know, protect the rights of the transgender. So I put it in there. I just said, you know, I do have a daughter who's transgender, but that's not what upset me about Jordan. What upset me was, and it is true, the betrayal of the trust I had in him when I fought for his position and when I was advocate and his protector at the university. Well, when the article came out. Jordan tweeted it to his large number of followers. Then he tweeted, and the second tweet was, now it is true, there was a last conversation, which we can come to later. And after that conversation, after that conversation, which was our last conversation, he called me a number of times and I wouldn't return the calls. And that's true. So that's not a misrepresentation. That's a real statement of fact. And I didn't have a problem with that. I thought he was taking the high road. The reason I did not answer the call is because in that last conversation, when I was telling him what I thought, he would, and it's not unusual in my interactions with Jordan, say, no, no, wait, Bernie, I got to tell you something. And his convictions were so strong that there was no accessing them, and he was not interested in hearing what you had to say because he knew he was right. But that was okay. Then an hour later, he tweets, I think I have this one here, and it's worth reading because the particular wording of it. Okay. An hour later, he tweets the following. I know Bernie to be a tireless advocate for his daughter, who has faced serious health problems. As someone who has been in the same situation, he does have an ill daughter, I can truly sympathize and presume only that my reaction to the C-16 was too close to the bone. So he managed to do it. He managed to say that my problem with him was the old C-16 because the illness of my child made that too close to the bone. Now, the readers of the article know that I have a trans child. And then he says this, so what are the illnesses people will imagine he's talking about? Well, psychiatric or an illness so dire that we are in constant state of stress. So it's sort of ridiculous, and Jordan knows that. My daughter was born hydrocephalic. That's a plumbing problem in the brain, so that the fluid that's generated in the center of the brain has to be drained off, and they put in a shunt, and it drains it. Before shunts were invented, children who were hydrocephalic would have their heads grow and the brain compressed and be brain damaged, and it was usually terminal. Well, Jade has a congenital blockage in her brain and has had a shunt her whole life. Now, there was some concern at the beginning as to whether Jade would have cognitive difficulties. Well, the short version is that Jade has gave up a promising career as a violin and viola performer to go and get a PhD at the University of Chicago, has a coveted tenured track position at a very fine college in the United States. And at the time of Bill C-16 was in fact preparing a paper that she'd been invited to give to a small group of people in Jerusalem, all expenses paid. Jade is doing just fine. We're doing just fine. Jade has a plumbing problem. When the plumbing goes awry, you fix the plumbing. It was not close to the bone. Jade is a bit of a miracle, given how well she is. And I thought what Jordan did was foul, absolutely foul, and extraordinarily misleading in a way that Jordan misleads. If people said to him, well, you said that transgender is an illness, he said, no, I just said that he had an illness. Well, the illness is, what's the illness? Oh, well, you just heard. So he just put two things together to create a reason for his followers to discredit what I wrote. Now, if there's any question that it worked, I can tell you I've been getting emails from people saying, why don't you get Dr. Peterson to treat your child? I do not go on social media. I imagine it's full of that. And I do know from people who do that the general now to refute my article is that, oh, he has a transgender child. So that was pretty nasty. And I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to tell that because I think that it's also a perfect example, actually a perfect example of what Jordan does. People ask me why I didn't give examples of the things I talk about. Well, if I had done that, I would have written a book. I was a neuroscientist in my first iteration. And there was a time we believed that everything, we will answer all problems of human experience deductively, right? Mm-hmm. But I think what's happened now is that people are really understanding we'll never really be able to reduce consciousness to a neural network. It's just not going to happen. And the increasing number of neuroscientists are saying we've come to a place that, you know, will remain elusive. Now, identity is part of consciousness. And how he presumes to know another person's experience when he says there's no such thing. The thing about people's experience of identity, he says, identity is determined, but we could also construct it socially. And somebody can decide they want to be a woman and, they construct an identity as a woman and they believe it. But there are a whole bunch of things that really argue against that. So when you have a 1.5-year-old child or a 2-year-old child, let's say boy, saying to his mother, as soon as he can say anything, that I'm a girl, wanting to put on dresses instead of boys' clothes, wanting to play with dolls and not trucks, what does he know to be constructing an identity? He's expressing something that he feels. This is who that person is, and we have no understanding of what identity is. I know I'm a man. People know there are women. But, we take that for granted. That's our biology. That's how we were brought up. We look in the mirror, men and women. But there are people, now quite famous, who knew their whole lives that they were in the wrong gender. And some of these people, I guess the most famous one is Jan Morris, who was a Welsh historian and an author and a travel writer. And she was born in 1926. And as a substantial historian and an important person, she came out as a trans woman, as a trans man. No, I mean, Jan is a trans man. She came out as a trans woman in 1972. And she has written a biography of her experience growing up, knowing that she was a woman and living as a man. There are a number of books like that written by people who are not psychiatrically disturbed. They're high-functioning, very smart people who kept their stories private until there was an opportunity to tell it. And there's a correspondent, there's a writer from the New York Times whose name escapes me right now. There's a famous scientist at Stanford. A lot of people now feel like they can say what their experience has been their whole lives. They suffered because of it, and now they're free of it. So for Jordan to presume that identity is tied to biology is extraordinarily stupid, because we cannot know another person's experience, and he questions their experience. That's what's so remarkable.
I did want to ask you about that final phone conversation with Dr. Peterson.
Well, when all this happened and I started seeing what was going on at the university, I left the university a long time ago. I took early retirement and been doing other things. I got really upset. And I emailed Jordan and said, look, I'm really finding what you're doing reprehensible. I think you're lying. I think you're misrepresenting science. I think it's, given your status of professor, it's just, I said, I don't want to talk about it. It's too upsetting for me to talk about it. I just want you to know this. He called me the next morning at 8:00 and he said, Bernie, we have to talk. We have to talk. So I started repeating what I'm saying, and he said, Just 1 minute, Bernie. Just Bernie. He's very intense when he speaks. I want you to know I'll give up everything, my job, my everything, because I really believe this, he said. And then he says, and Tammy, his wife, had a dream. I said, okay, what was the dream? She dreamt it was 5 minutes to midnight. And I said, okay, Jordan, I don't think there's much to talk about. And then Jordan has been calling ever since, and I do not take the calls.
I mean, that bit about the prophetic dream, it sort of gets at the core of what has personally worried me about Dr. Peterson. His sort of preacher-esque style is starting to develop what is amounting to an online cult of followers.
Well, that's why I think that's exactly the problem. I think that he has many different followers, by the way. I mean, some of the followers are reasonable people, thoughtful. Some of them don't know enough about Jordan. But there is a large group of followers, and mostly male, mostly white, who are pretty angry, nasty people. And the anger and the nastiness shows up in their tweets. They go after anybody who objects to Jordan, and they do it in a very nasty way. Got a lot of emails from people that were extremely moving and positive, and many of them began with, how brave of you to do this. People are afraid of Jordan. They're afraid to go up against him, but what they're really afraid of are his followers. And women in particular are, he's created a climate of fear, which I discovered when I started writing this, among women academics and women writers and editors who have things to say about Jordan who will now not say them. And I think I think that's what's really, I think he's doing this out of conviction. Actually, I'm not even sure. Jordan is hard to pin down. I think it's possible that there's a driving conviction here that's so great, and an anxiety about the future of the world and the future of society that makes him do these things. But he's not paying attention to who his followers are. And he doesn't criticize them. And the largest number of his followers seem like pretty scary people.
When I was younger, I went through that period of sort of being like an angry young man. I'm 27 now. I got out of that. I moved very much to a more progressive side of things. How can we steer young men away from, you know, the toxicity of this stuff like the alt-right and misogynistic thought, in your opinion?
Let me ask you a question. When you were a young man of that nature, what would you have steered you away from it? I think that I don't have an answer to that. I think that these people are drawn to Jordan for a reason. I think these are, I don't know them, but they sure sound like angry, disaffected, alienated, angry people. And he has a message to them that makes them feel seen and understood and enabled. And they have found in Jordan somebody who validates them. And for large numbers of them, I think there are people who are helped by Jordan. I wouldn't deny that. But I think a large number of people feel enabled in a scary way. And I think whatever the reason is that these young men feel so angry and disaffected has to be addressed before you could detoxify Jordan's effect. I think there's no talking to them. I think they have found their, if you'll pardon the expression, savior. And Jordan does think of himself as a savior. I think he really is. His message to me was, I would do anything. It's 5 minutes to midnight. I'm going to save the world.